The Tale of the Frozen Pussy, Slipper Trip, The Million Dollar Fee. These are just a few of the strange cases and wild tales you will hear on Miami Memoirs. Join Florida attorney Louis Ress as he recounts his 6 decades of legal practice in the wilds of South Florida.
Hi everyone, this is Jeanette, your host for the podcast Miami Memoirs with Louis Ress, and we're about to start episode 12, Eli Is At You. So Louis, I'm very excited to hear about the story.
Thank you. I'm glad to share it with you.
Well, actually, you had left off in an earlier episode. You mentioned something about Cornell and your experience there. You actually had not a great time with someone in admissions, and it turned out that you had been accepted. They had actually sent you a letter of acceptance, and you ended up going there, right?
That's right. I went all the way home on the Lehigh Valley Railroad from my interview at Cornell, believing that I was rejected. They had told me I would fit in at Columbia University in New York, and that's where I belonged, and that I would fit in well there, with the implication that it would not fit in well at Cornell. So this is what happened after I got accepted to Cornell. The acceptance had been waiting for me, and up to Cornell I go.
Oh, great.
So it was surreal, and I was up there at Cornell. Without doubt, Cornell has the most beautiful campus in the world. Its trees turn yellow and then orange and then red at about this time of the year, the fall at the start of the school, the fall year. And the wind blew and the air was clear and it was cool. Cornell is located on an imposing hill overlooking Cayuga Lake. On the summit are cut fieldstone buildings covered with ivy. It's the Ivy League. And surrounding the buildings were lawns and open quadrangles, and they were divided by paths, walking paths, and they were flanked by statues of the founding fathers. And there's a story about the two founding fathers, Andrew White and Ezra Cornell. And what happened is they have one on each side of the campus on the quadrangle. And supposedly, if a virgin lady walks by between the two statues, they jump up, run to the middle of the campus, and shake hands. It's a terrible joke. Nowadays, women would not tolerate it. But in those days, it was deemed to be funny. Anyhow, there was this very busy excitement around the school. And the library tower rises right out of that quadrangle of buildings. It's really beautiful. And, of course, the bells ring at noon. So you walk around and the bells are ringing and everybody is going someplace and doing something. And on each side of the campus, there were gorges cut into the sedimentary rock, and they had waterfalls. And these were caused by ancient receding glaciers.
Wow.
It's a beautiful place. Mm-hmm. It's just gorgeous. And everyone had been their class valedictorian except me. In fact, they were all angry because they all felt they should have been accepted at Harvard. And so they had something to prove, that Harvard had made a mistake and that they were smarter than the kids that get into Harvard.
Hmm.
So it's a very competitive atmosphere.
I bet, yeah.
And Eli, I got assigned to a room. All the freshmen had to live on campus. Eli was a fellow living in the next room in my old wooden military barracks dormitory. And they had barracks there from World War II that they still used to house the freshman students. Eli was rooming with Paul Feeney, and I was with Ronald Dodd III. Feeney was on a full scholarship from the streets of South Boston. He was a real Southie from the slums of Boston. And if I was supposed to learn something by meeting people of different backgrounds at Cornell, it would appear that I would have had one hell of a learning experience. And fast, because these were wild, different kind of people I'm used to. Feeney was never around. He left in the late afternoon, and he came in drunk at about 2 o'clock in the morning every single night, and then he slept it off the next day. He lasted for about a month before they threw him out, and he said he was glad to leave and that he had enjoyed a wonderful educational experience.
And what about Ron Dodd? What was he like?
Well, that was my roommate. Ron Dodd was another living lesson in life. He was 6 feet tall, clean cut, with dark hair combed and slicked back close to his head. He had shirts with monograms, he wore ballet shoes, and he wore bow ties. He spoke slowly and distinctly, selecting his words with care. He didn't have an accent the way I do. I have this New York accent. He spoke very elegantly. Mm-hmm. His family owned Dodd Industries, and if he hadn't been required to be in the freshman dorm, he would have rented a large house for himself. He was a wealthy fellow. There were no freshman cars allowed, so he had a Cord convertible, but that was home. You know what a Cord convertible is?
No.
It's a very fancy car that they built with big tubes coming out of the side of the engine the fender. It's a very
I bet it went pretty fast.
Oh, yeah. And that was at home. He left that at home in Cleveland. He came from Cleveland.
And what about Eli? Who was he? What was he like?
Well, Eli was dark-skinned, dark hair, dark, bright eyes, short, quiet, and alert, whose eyes flashed. The fraternities were visiting the freshmen for rushing. And this was, you know, where they invite you to come to the fraternity house, and they look at you and you look at them, mm-hmm. and then they give you a bid if they like you.
Right, they try to recruit you.
Right, and they have a class, let's say, of 10 new freshmen every year come into the fraternity or so.
Fresh meat.
Right, and they may issue 15 bids and 10 get accepted. Mm-hmm. 10 accept the bids and are taken in and initiated in the fraternities.
I see.
There were about 50 fraternities, and they ran the social life at Cornell. And without being in a fraternity, there wasn't much of a social life in the college life in the real rah-rah college days. And I was visited by about 8 fraternities. Ron Dodd was fought over by at least 20 of the top ones, including Sigma Chi and DKE.
What about DKE? Why were they so popular?
DKE is Delta Kappa Epsilon, and they're a national fraternity, and they are a heavy drinking group.
Oh, okay.
They're very, very wild guys, and as a matter of fact, I'll tell you more about it.
Is it the fraternity that Judge Kavanaugh belonged to?
Yeah, Associate Justice Kavanaugh was a member of DEEK, but at Yale, and it's a heavy drinking fraternity. I tried to get a copy of the charter of DKE because I had mentioned it in my story before Associate Justice Kavanaugh was appointed to the court.
Right.
And I can't get it. They won't release it. Oh. But I can tell you, as I recall, to my best recollection, that it was a fraternity that only accepted white Christian gentlemen.
Hmm.
No blacks, right. No Hispanics, no Jews. And that never came out in the Kavanaugh hearings. I think it would have damaged him
even more than
the drunkenness problems that he had. Because kids drink, and I'll tell you about binge drinking at schools in a little later. But
Interesting, though, that the charter that you don't have access to, who was part of
I can't get it.
And it's private information for some reason?
No,
it's
a private organization, and it's private information.
Okay.
And the schools don't even keep copies of the charters of the fraternities, even though the fraternities exist on the school's property on the campus,
that doesn't
often
sound very
in
smart.
Buildings owned by the school.
Yeah, that's crazy. It's crazy to think.
Anyhow, the fraternities came in to my room, in the dorm room, mostly to chat with Ron Dodd, but not with me. These fellows from Sigma Chi and the other elegant fraternities wore 3-button sport coats with striped ties. They had white buckskin shoes with light pink soles or wine-covered loafers.
Wow.
They were all blonde and tall, and they all seemed to have blue eyes, and they kept coming. So this is, and I'll talk to you more about that. That's the Nordic look.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're talking about nowadays in immigration and in race relations. The white elegant people, these are WASPs, white American Protestants. So they kept coming. At least 20 groups came, but they hardly noticed me.
Did they ever try to engage with you at all? Or
not at all.
They just ignored you.
Well, they didn't. They said hello.
Yeah.
They weren't rude. But they were not
they
particularly warm or friendly or encouraged. They didn't fight me.
Right.
So the fraternities that rushed me were very refined, well-mannered men, but they didn't wear monogram shirts. There was something different about the young men who were inviting Don to cocktails and dinner at their gorgeous, beautiful, huge fraternity houses with cut stone. They were elegant places, 3 stories high, with private meeting rooms, underground chambers and stuff. And I couldn't figure it out why they were rushing him and not rushing me. So I said, Rod, you know, why is this occurring? And he said, Lewis, surely you understand that you can't be pledged to Sigma Chi, Lewis. You're Jewish. I said, what? And it hit me like a ton of bricks.
I'm sure it did.
And Rod would have never used that expression, you know. But Cornell, this liberal bastion of open-minded, inquisitive learning, this intellectual beacon of light, this educational oasis in the hills of the Finger Lakes wine country, the first university to accept women on an equal footing, supported anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. And these fraternities, located right on the campus, had it directly in their charters, no Jews allowed. Years later, when I confronted the school's vice president, she said, after initially denying it, that the alumni of these fraternities were very powerful.
So that gave them the right to just be anti-Semitic openly?
Well, they're private organizations. You can have a private organization today. They have the Palm Beach Yacht Club. No Jews, no blacks, and it's a private club. And the only thing is you're not allowed to use federal money or to open it up for outside parties or engagements for income. And it's a private club, and you can do that.
And they can do whatever.
Today you can do it, and I think they do still. The last time we had a Cornell function there, I complained and they stopped going there. But that was my first experience with anti-Semitism. What an education I was getting at Cornell. Wow.
Very sad.
To
be confronted with that after probably hearing so many good things and looking forward to this experience so badly, you know, all of a sudden get confronted with racism like right off the bat.
Well, I lived in a Jewish portion of New York City. Mm-hmm. And New York had a great many Jews in it. And I would say the bulk of the people, maybe 75% of the people where I lived, were Jewish. So I thought the whole world was Jewish. And I was never uncomfortable with anyone. Mm-hmm. I never thought of anybody being different than I. And I accepted whoever it was that I was dealing with for what they were. Mm-hmm. And I thought that that would certainly be the case at an Ivy League college. But it wasn't. It wasn't. So that was my first experience with anti-Semitism, part of my getting my college education. I got educated. Finally, I was bid to join a wonderful fraternity. It was called Phi Sigma Delta. It was academically oriented, and it was a well-to-do party boy fraternity of my religious confreres. They were all Jews. And that's what happens. The Jews form their own country clubs, too, when they can't get
in. Of course.
Now, this Phi Sig rented an older but large house on the side of the hill with a great view of Lake Cayuga. And all my fraternity brothers became doctors, lawyers, or engineers, except for Bill Levitt Jr., who went into the family housing development business, Levittown.
Is that the city of Levittown on Long Island?
Yeah.
Oh.
He was quite wealthy. They built all over Levittowns, and they did them in France, too. And I'm sure they were an extremely wealthy family. Hmm. But nobody ever came to visit Eli. Eli was in the Industrial and Labor Relations College at Cornell, and he was pro-labor. So there it was. I still hear from some of my fraternity brothers. Ron Dodd went his way after the freshman year, and I did see the white cord, his car, parked at his three-story stone fraternity house, but I was never invited in.
Mm-hmm. And they I found that... They kept with their racist ways, I guess. To this day, probably, they still have that.
Yeah, and I was never invited into any of the non-Jewish fraternity houses. I was occasionally invited into another Jewish fraternity. If they had a party, we would invite them, they would invite us, and we would bring our dates and go back and forth. That happened occasionally, but not with the non-Jewish fraternities. Anyhow, I got along with Eli very well, and he and I roomed together in our sophomore year. And I used to take him to our fraternity house for dinner or for a cocktail party, and everyone liked him, but he never had a date. And my fraternity never even thought of pledging him because he wasn't elegant enough.
Hmm.
I'll use that
word.
Is
that why he couldn't get a date? Or
right. He was a short, and he was not affluent, and he was not handsome.
Poor Eli.
Yeah, well, it wasn't poor Eli. Eli was no slouch. I'll tell you more about Eli. The stories about Eli. This is the dressing around the story.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, I got to talking to Eli more and more, and he opened up, And I learned that he spoke three languages, that he read a lot, he played chess, and he had amazing hobbies. One of his hobbies was mnemonics.
Oh, what is mnemonics?
Mnemonics is the science, if you will, of memorization.
Okay.
So you study something, and a lot of our education is repeating back memory, the 5 points of this and the 10 points of that, and we memorize it for our tests. So it's a lot of memorizing. Mm-hmm. And memory is a science. There's ways of learning to memorize lists, concepts, and to parrot it back with tricks, with mental gymnastics, if you will. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you more about that. And he also was interested in hypnotism.
Oh, did he ever ask you if you wanted to get hypnotized?
Well, he we wound up in show business together, and he was doing hypnosis.
Oh, wow. That is so cool.
Yeah, so I was involved with professional hypnosis through him. He was quite a guy. He could memorize an entire magazine that had just come out. Every page, every ad, page by page, for 50 pages, photographs, name a page number, and he could describe the picture or the article on that page. And that's amazing. I think it's called indexing. That's the whole thing.
Oh, okay.
Anyhow, by this time, I had felt the need to increase my bank account. My father, who, as you may recall, was a struggling attorney just in Brooklyn, he could afford just so much. And I was in this very well-to-do fraternity with the likes of Bill Levitt from Levittown.
Yeah.
So these are, you know, enormously multi-millionaires. When my fraternity brothers suggested that it was not gentlemanly for me to set up a table and sell neckties at other fraternity houses, Eli took over my necktie business. And he went around to the fraternity houses after dinner, and he displayed the rep ties, you know, these striped ties that you see today.
Yeah.
Well, they came out in the 50s, the first time.
Oh.
That was when they became popular. And
you took that opportunity and what was it?
Well, yeah, I was like that. I still am.
That's
so
great.
I saw these ties. I said, well, I got to find out where they're manufactured. And I went into New York City on the Lower East Side, and I found out some places that were making them there.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought them by the gross, 144 ties in a big box, and brought them up to Cornell and started selling them at the fraternity houses.
How much did you sell them a piece?
I bought them for $2 each and sold them for $7.
Oh.
That's a pretty good marker.
Profit, yeah.
And Eli used to take them out and sell them because my fraternity objected to my going around selling them.
Mm-hmm.
So Eli and I split the profits.
Oh.
He didn't have to put up anything except go out and sell them. And then he gave me an envelope every night on my desk with money in it.
That's good business.
I was making money without doing anything.
Yeah.
And he was making money without investing anything.
Residual income right there.
Yeah. So, and he was a good salesman. He never displayed the same tie twice. You know, you can't if you're merchandising. You don't want to sell the same dress in the window of the store. You know, hide the other dresses until you sell the first one. Mm-hmm. Then you bring out the next dress.
Yeah. So it shows it's high demand. It's unique.
Right.
What else did you do to make money at that time?
Well, I played the saxophone and the clarinet.
Oh, I played the clarinet in high school.
You did?
Yeah.
Well, I had a very fine clarinet. I had a pencil mullet clarinet, which is a pretty good one.
Okay.
And I formed a dance band with three other half-baked musicians. We didn't play so well, but we could play dance music, and the fraternities always needed bands. And my fraternity didn't object to my being a band leader.
Mm-hmm.
So I said to Eli, you know, you do hypnosis. Why don't we create a hypnosis act for about an hour and a half, which you would, you know, do a hypnosis, and then I would do the music with the band. So we did. We featured Eli putting his subjects under hypnosis, and then he made them cry, perspire, shiver, and shake when he suggested it was cold.
Yeah.
You can't fake that. And the highlight involved a pair of empty eyeglass frames, and he put his fingers through the open frames, and then he announced that with these glasses, his subjects would be able to see people without their clothes on, naked. Well, it worked. The subjects put on, the kids, you know, that were in the audience, that volunteered to be hypnotized. They put on the glasses, and they put on one crazy show. They went wild, looking the girls up and down, screaming and yelling. The audience went wild. One guy actually threw the glasses on the floor and stomped on them.
Wow.
He was so embarrassed. He was so upset.
It had to have been real, then. Experience.
Oh yeah, yeah. It was
for
real.
Them to you know, get such a visceral reaction to it.
Now we became famous, and Eli particularly became famous. And I stopped playing with my band, and I began booking bands and putting Eli in for an hour in three different times during the night.
That sounds so fun. So we were like an agent.
He gave 3 one-hour performances with 3 different bands at 3 different fraternity houses.
Wow.
And we cleaned up. That's I made a lot of money for to help my father get me through school.
Nice.
And then Eli came up with another idea. He said, we'll put on a big show in Willard Strait Hall, which that's the Student Union building at the time. It's a beautiful building. We didn't know how to do it. So we got a hold of Kiwanis. We looked up Kiwanis in Ithaca, and we got them to sponsor the show. They sold the tickets, and we gave them half the profits. Mm-hmm. And we put on the show.
Oh, okay.
Eli and I did the show, and the show was called Eli the Great Hypnotist. It was going to be a show of hypnosis, and it was so much to do. Well, hold everything. After we rented the hall and we got the tickets out, they were printed, Cornell decides that there'll be no hypnosis on campus.
Oh,
Eli came up with it again. He was very creative. In addition to his memory feats, he would perform mind reading, extrasensory perception. You know what that is? Mental telepathy.
Oh, okay.
And he would defy any student or professor to debunk us. He would show that he was clairvoyant. You know what clairvoyant is? He could mind reading.
Huh.
So it was great. Eli decided that he could predict the score of the New York Knicks professional basketball game 2 days before the actual game.
Wow.
And he would post it in a notarized prediction in a sealed envelope with the flap of the envelope signed by the president of the university, and it was to be placed in a locked glass container or a case right outside the Student Union Auditorium on the wall, and to be opened by a professor on the night of the performance in front of the entire audience.
Wow. So what happened? Did
we
get
did
it right?
We did it.
Wow.
I'll tell you about it. Anyhow, we took an ad in the student newspaper and in the Ithaca Journal, the local city newspaper, and the Cornell Daily News gave us a good write-up, and we sold out. We sold 200 seats. And so the night of the performance, 200 students, faculties, and locals filled every seat at Willard Strait Hall.
That's awesome.
And here I am. You think I think we were a couple of sophomores. It was an impressive room. That room is 3 stories high inside, and it's all paneled with leaded windows. It's almost like a church. And I was the master of ceremonies, and we introduced some of the faculty member judges. And Eli comes out in a suit, and he starts off with his memory feats. So he was terrific.
Yeah, he established that he could do it.
Right. I held up a 50-page magazine that had just come out that day, and I tore off pages and distributed the pages through the audience. And I said, feel free to raise your hands, and I'll come around and give you the mic, and you can ask Eli anything about the page you're holding, and he'll describe cartoons, pictures, articles. Are you concerned that Eli might be able to see some hidden screen? We'll blindfold him. No, you can blindfold him. You can blindfold him.
So he could really memorize all that. That's amazing.
Yeah, he could. And it's using these mnemonic devices.
Mm-hmm. Using science, pretty much. He trained himself.
Right. Right, exactly. And, of course, we started with the truth. And he really did it. So it was easy after that. The audience was in our hands. While double blindfolded by a professor, after placing coins over Eli's eyes, I escorted Eli through the audience, and he read off serial numbers of dollar bills that people took out of their pockets. Then back on stage, I held up placards, one with a large square, another with waves, lines, wavy lines, mm-hmm. another with circles, and another with a triangle. And as I held them in the air, the audience was asked to concentrate on the form on the card, and Eli would read their minds.
Oh.
And Eli said, someone in here is trying to play a game with me and is concentrating on the wrong form because you stand out. Please don't do that. You make it difficult. Everyone else is being honest. So, it's the triangle. And
so
it was.
Do you have any idea how he was able to do something like that?
Yes, I do.
Are you going to share it with us later?
Yeah, I will.
I'm intrigued. I really want to know how he was able to do that.
I'm going to tell you about levitation. I'm going to tell you about a lot of stuff,
okay.
About seances, about, you know, seances, communication
uh-huh.
with the dead.
With the dead, yeah.
I'll tell you about magic, stuff that you can't believe, and I'll explain it to you if you want. That should be a whole separate discussion. Yeah. Magic.
Fascinated.
These stories that I write keep bringing in or leading into other branches of life that become exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I'm enthusiastic about it. And it's entertaining. So I'll tell you, first of all, I'll tell you what happened with the basketball prediction.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you predict the score of a game 2 days before and have it notarized and put in a sealed envelope signed by the president of the university in a glass case 2 days before it's on view for everyone to see? Well, few people to this day know how it was done. The dean of the College of Arts and Sciences comes on the stage and he's introduced and he raises his right hand. He says that he knows nothing about this challenge. He had never spoken to Eli or to me about this prediction or what he was about to do. He told the audience that he had indeed visited with the president of the university and was assured by the president that he had signed the envelope before it was placed in the glass case 2 days before the basketball game. The dean then walks outside and unlocks the case and brings in the envelope. He showed the envelope to everybody, and on the flap it says, signed by the president of the university. He sliced the envelope open and it showed the letter inside to the audience. The letter described the date of the notary, which was 2 days before the Knicks game, and showed Eli's signature. He then read, "I, Eli Taba, do hereby predict that the New York Knicks will defeat the Boston Celtics in the game scheduled at Madison Square Garden on," and there was a date, which I've long since forgotten. "The point spread will be 3 points, and the score will be Knicks 95 and the Celtics 92. Actually, the Knicks beat the Celtics 97-94.
Wow.
Close enough.
Yes.
Close enough.
Yes.
Eli was famous, but no fraternity ever invited him for dinner.
Why wasn't he invited to dinner? He was so charming. He had done all this.
Because you're learning something, and you're learning it today about Browns and Blacks and minority groups, Jews and Muslims and Catholics even in our society, and how the large number of people who are white Americans resent and feel that they have to protect the American heritage, which is white. Mm. And that's what they think, white is American. And that's how they feel, and Christian, and they want to have Christianity as part of the national religion.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a whole, not just in the schools, but it's a national religion. So
yeah, they didn't see his talents for what they were. They saw it as a threat, as
exactly.
other, and threatened.
Exactly.
Threatened by
him. Different.
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 Anything that's different.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it was 1951, and the Korean War was in full bloom, and I was in ROTC, which is Reserve Officers Training Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I got paid money to do that, which helped me a lot with school. After the third year as an undergraduate, I was accepted into the Cornell Law School. They took two students a year from the third year and let them go into law school a year early.
Mm-hmm.
And I slid into a pit of heavy workloads and tough competition. The law school was murder. It was the paper chase.
Mm-hmm.
It was terrible. I didn't see Eli or any of my fraternity brothers during that time. The reading assignments were beyond possible. You just couldn't do it. And I learned later that you had to form a group and each one had to do a portion of it. And then you met and exchanged the highlights. That was the only way to do
it. Yeah.
You couldn't do it otherwise. There were 20 cases a day to read and 20 pages of text in each subject. And it was physically impossible.
Right. Yeah, it's a teamwork. On
right.
That.
There was no time to eat or bathe or sleep.
And you did this all in 3 years, right? Instead of four.
Well, I did college in 3 years,
mm-hmm.
and then law school in the regular 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
So after the first year of law school, the Army made me a second lieutenant. And then I received my diploma from the College of Arts and Sciences after my first year of law school. At that time, Eli graduated when I got my commission, and he was accepted at Yale Law School. He's a very bright man. And last I heard about Eli was that while at Yale, he had written a book, How to Avoid the Draft. And then he was drafted the day after it was published. These are true stories. I keep saying that because it's so weird, the stuff. Anyhow, I was allowed to finish law school by the military. And then I served 2 years on active duty. So, and that's coming up in the next story, in the story of my military life. But word drifted back that Eli was at Yale,
mm-hmm.
And years later, the rumor was that Eli had disappeared. So he served a couple of years in the military,
mm-hmm.
drafted, and then came back to Yale, and then they lost track of him. The people thought that he might be in Israel, and the word was that he owned two nursing homes.
So he did like a Houdini act and kind of vanished for a bit.
Not a little bit. He's still vanished.
Yeah?
I can't find him.
To this day?
Time went by, and I was living in Miami. It was probably in the 1980s. And I was going up the courthouse steps, the famous courthouse steps in the Dade County Courthouse downtown. And on the top of the steps, there was Eli.
Wow. After all these years, you guys saw each other.
Right. I couldn't believe it. It sure was Eli. Nobody in the world looked exactly like him. He looked me straight in the eyes. Then he looked around us quickly. His eyes darted left and darted right. It was Eli. That's how he looked. He sounded like Eli. He said, "Sir, my name is Harold Carrington." No. I said, "Eli, please talk to me." True story. He says, "I am an attorney with my office in the Capital Bank building. Here is my card, and I am very busy, and I must excuse myself."
Oh, no.
Don't tell me. It was Eli Tapper, and I must have blown his cover. He clearly was working as a spy. There was no Harold Carrington registered with the Florida Bar. I stopped short of checking his office in the Capital Bank building. I didn't want to do any more damage to him. Anyhow, he probably was at least listed in the directory, so I called up Yale Law School. They didn't have any record of him. And I know that Yale is a well-known recruiting ground for the CIA.
And what did you do next?
Well, I did a stupid thing, which for me is not unusual. That night, I told this story to my friend Jack and his wife, Alana. After all, and we're going to have dinner with them tonight. After all, it was exciting. She's an Israeli, and I had thought that she was an Israeli spy more than once. You know, a sleeper told to marry an American and report back to the Mossad. So what did she do? I found out later that she picked up the phone book. In those days, we still had them. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, there's a listing in Miami for Eli Tapper.
Oh.
So she calls Eli Tapper on the phone. She's an aggressive woman. And his wife answers. And Alana says that it was urgent that she contact Eli. She said that Eli was in New York City staying with his brother. So Alana said it was an emergency, and she got the number, and she called him at his brother's home in New York.
Wow.
She told him that she was my friend, and he told her never to call him again, and he hung up, and he was gone forever.
Wow.
It surely was Eli. So I've looked. There's no telephone listing for Eli Tapper anywhere, as I've tried. Cornell has no record of him. Yale Law School has no record of any Eli Tapper. I called up Cornell, the Southeast representative for Cornell. They can't find him. He's gone forever.
He was brilliant. I can tell he's a brilliant man to be able to pull that off.
And he's some guy, some character. And I missed him. I lost my friendship with him, which I never realized. I was so busy leading my own life and becoming involved with my own interests and myself, being selfish, that I lost my friendship with him.
Well, Eli, if you're listening, reach out to Lewis because he wants to reconnect.
So. Right, but his real name is not Tapper, but it's close, very close. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, if you like, I'll tell you some of the secrets, and then we can talk about it.
Yes, yes. I want to know.
Would you like to know how we predicted the game?
Yes.
I'll tell you, but you have to promise not to tell anyone else. So is everyone listening? Promise? Okay, I hear you. Well, a notary can notarize a signature only. So if you write your signature on a blank piece of paper, the notary can put sworn to and subscribe before me this blank day. You don't even have to put it. Just put a notary stamp under your signature.
Oh.
They can do a signature. So Eli took 3 sheets of blank paper, and he had a notary sign, stamp, and seal authenticating Eli's signature. Just the signature alone. And he did that 2 days before the game. Then he had the university president sign 3 unsealed envelopes. Just put their flaps down, and he signed right over the flaps, 3 of them, so that we could get the best one that fit when we sealed it, that would fit together.
Right.
Then we had the custodian of the building lend us the key to the glass case. We told him that we needed it for the show. And after the game, we wrote out the prediction. We typed it in, and we decided that it would look too phony if it was the exact score.
Yeah.
We wanted it to look good. So we made it very close.
Mm-hmm.
And we, you know, the winner and the loser and the point spread was exactly correct. And we carefully sealed the envelope so that the signature on the flap matched perfectly. Then at 3 o'clock in the morning, we replaced the dummy envelope with the envelope to be opened at the show. And that's how we did it.
Perfect. Wow. A lot of work went into that.
Well, it's a trick and it's a fraud. Mm-hmm. And so much of...
Yeah, there's a lot of undercurrents and hidden matters in all of your stories. So this sort of, you know, plays into that.
Right. Well, this one, I'm going to do today in all three of these discussions is to ramble a little. And you'll get the feeling of the story and the issues, and they'll sort of weave together and flow around one another. And it'll be like bouncing off different rocks in a rapids stream of water flowing around them. And we talk about, first about Eli. You mentioned the color of his skin and mm-hmm. Dark hair. And he had like dark skin, you know. And this is not what America likes. Mm-hmm. They like tall, Nordic, blonde guys, 6'2", blonde hair, blue eyes. No deformities, no limbs missing or fingers missing or club feet or limps. They got to be athletic, mm-hmm. have to smile a lot, and they have to wear the right clothes.
Come from a certain background.
They have to be affluent, yeah. And they have to speak in a certain way. So that's what they look for. And it's a stereotype, and that's the pattern. And so when you get a short guy who's swarthy, who doesn't dress well because he's poor and shoes may not be shined, they're not interested in your intellect. They're not interested in the depth of your comprehension of life. Hmm. They're interested in a facade.
It's pretty shallow to me. So.
It is, and it exists today. Now, you see, today, the Norwegian type is, when you talk, like President Trump talked about immigration. They want to restrict immigration from certain areas and countries where people are poor, where people don't look typically American, white, blue-eyed, mm-hmm. tall. So the Nordics are favored, the Scandinavians are favored, as opposed to people from India, mm-hmm. or people from China, or people from Africa.
Not speak. Just that, but then he also cut back on the racial sensitivity training.
Well,
because he said it was anti-American.
Right, I can tell you a lot of those things.
That's crazy.
Right. And what is American? This is what we're talking
exactly.
about.
Exactly. What is American?
Also, there was some talk about in some of these rallies about go back to where you came from.
Uh-huh.
I forget. I think that was in the debates.
That would be everyone.
Well, a lot of people, you know.
Except for the Native Americans, everyone would have to leave.
Right. There was a great song. The very first Americans were foreigners too.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
The people that came over on the Mayflower
yes.
were foreigners.
Yes.
The DuPonts from the DuPont Chemical mm-hmm. Company, they came from France. You know? Mm-hmm. We're all foreigners. At any rate, there was a movement, you know, come back, go back to where you came from.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll talk to you. You know, you ever hear of Marcus Garvey? No.
Yes.
You have?
I heard, yeah. He was...
I don't mean to put you on the spot.
I don't want to misspeak.
It's unfair.
Tell me. Yeah.
Well, Marcus Garvey, he came from the islands. I think it was Jamaica.
Mm.
And he owned a company, came up to New York and went into the Harlem area. And he owned a line called the Black Star Shipping Line. And he was trying to get business.
Mm-hmm.
So he came up with this idea that the black people, particularly in Harlem, mm-hmm. should go back to Africa.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want you. They don't like you. The hell with them. Go back to Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So he was shipping. His line would take you back to Africa.
Uh-huh.
And they went back and they actually reformed a country called Liberia. Liberia is from liberty.
Mm-hmm.
And the capital of Liberia is Monrovia. And it's on the west coast of Africa. And Monrovia is named after Monroe, who is President Monroe.
Oh.
You never knew that.
No, I didn't.
So the whole, I think that the white people in the United States should take a course. Everyone should take a course in black studies.
Yes.
It would open a lot of eyes for people, mm-hmm. what the black people have gone through and mm-hmm. are going through.